Right, exactly. And we can take the opportunity to get into this when, you know, may not always be able to get into detail on stuff. So I guess the first thing is, what's the big idea of your campaign? What is your main force that's driving you to do all this crazy stuff?
Well, the main thing is to be a voice for the people in Portland that aren't really feeling that they're represented in City Hall. So folks that are renting, folks that are, you know, not really high-income folks, folks that are feeling the pressure from our housing crisis, and folks that are dealing with the congestion out around our city, trying to travel around. I mean, basically, I wasn't satisfied with what I saw the other people offering in the race. You know, they're talking about a lot of the same problems that we all have been recognized that are problems here for years, you know, for decades. We've been dealing with a lot of the same problems. And one of the biggest things that people are having trouble dealing with is funding and revenue. And so for me, recognizing that housing was the most important issue and the most important crisis in our city right now was finding revenue to deal with that. And so I looked at what are the possibilities of how Portland could raise revenue. What are the sources that we already have? What are the tools at our disposal? And I decided, based on what I saw, that the best tool that we had at our disposal was a city income tax. And dedicating that funding to affordable housing to make sure that that top item, that's the emergency item on our agenda, is dealt with. You know, and in a responsible way, in a way that actually we can solve the problem within a reasonable time frame. And I, you know, I'm trying to challenge the other people who are in the race, who are talking about these problems, to also propose bold solutions that are actually sufficient to solve them. You know, I'd like to see them do that.
Yeah, have they?
And I have not seen them do that. So, so at this at this point, I'm still challenging them. You know, I'm seeing more emotion in that way. I heard Ted Wheeler say something about a sales tax at the Hispanic Pros Forum, which I can't say a sales tax would be my choice, because I don't think that's the most progressive way that we're going to be able to raise income in Portland for our government. But I think as long as people are talking about sources of revenue and we have that conversation, then that's healthy. Because if we don't have that conversation now, when it comes to the point where we're going to have to raise that revenue, we're not going to have actually vetted the ideas through the election process, which is a really important part of how we choose our representation. People need to talk about the ideas and how they plan to solve these problems.
Right.
If they're not going to say where they're going to get the funding from, then I feel like they're leaving out a really important part of the conversation that we need to have.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. So I want to get to transportation soon, but I think it's worth drilling in a little on the income tax thing. It seems like the obvious question is, how do you stop? You said there were like 700 people or something like this applies to? How do you stop 400 of them from moving to?
So the income tax proposal is to tax the top 1% of income earners in Portland. So that would be a group that maybe a few thousand taxpayers.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, probably less than, it would be definitely less than 6,000, probably more than 2,000, somewhere in that range. You know, and maybe all of those people will leave town, but I think that's really unlikely, quite honestly. You know, a lot of people that would have left town for tax burden reasons have already left. You know, we have a county tax, we have state income taxes that they don't have in Washington State. So folks that are really concerned about their tax burden in terms of where they're going to reside have probably not located themselves in Portland.
Right.
You know, in terms of anecdotal evidence, I mean, I asked Ted Wheeler, you know, would you move out of Portland if I put a tax on the top 1%? I mean, he'd have to pay it. He said he'd be fine with paying it, you know, because it's dedicated to a really important problem that we need to solve.
Right.
And so I think that there are a lot of people that would feel the same way about it as Ted Wheeler and would not leave town because they understand the value of what they would be getting for the money that the government would be collecting from them. You know, it's really just a matter of going where the income has gone. You know, all the income gains that we've seen in our economy over the last few years have basically gone to that top 1%. If we don't go to them to collect more revenue for our government, then we are asking people who are already paying you know, a great deal of their money towards the government to give even more when they're still hurting from this economy that we've been suffering through. You know, we have this recovery and we have low unemployment, but our wages are still really low and we aren't really getting compensated for this huge increase in productivity that workers have accomplished over the last 30 or 40 years. All of that income gain has gone to folks at the top of the income distribution.
Right.
And if we don't start correcting that at the city level, then we're not really going to be able to solve the problem because it's not getting dealt with at the state level. It's not getting dealt with at the national level right now. And so that's why we have these really big problems that are really expensive to solve. You know, and it's something that has to be done by government. We're not going to be able to solve our housing crisis by letting the market play itself out.
Right.
You know, we have to get involved, and we have to do it as a community, and we have to do it in a thoughtful way. You know, we have to think about where we're going to get the revenue from and how much we actually need and who can best support this. You know, and it seems to me, you know, we've already got payroll taxes and we've got property taxes and, you know, we've got a lot of different types of taxes, but personal income taxes in Portland are something that is a relatively new thing, But it's a really powerful tool that we have to actually take action locally that we can't really do otherwise.
So just to be clear, it's how many percentage points you're proposing on the 1%?
So I'm proposing an 8% tax on the incomes of the top 1% of income earners in Portland.
Right.
And I'm open to having a discussion about other ways to raise that revenue. That's really what I'm trying to do, is start the conversation. I'm not saying that I have the best perfectly calibrated answer to this problem. But given the fact that we're talking a lot on the national scale about the 1% versus the 99%, and given the very real disparity in where the income gains have gone, I think there's a very strong argument that that is the place to look if you're going to be trying to raise more revenue at the city level.
Right.
And whether that rate is necessary, you know, maybe the rate needs to be higher or lower to raise the amount of funds that we need. But that rate of 8% is based on the idea of collecting $200 million a year. And that's based on how much we need to solve this problem.
Mm-hmm.
If we want to have a mayor in there for two terms, which is all they can do, and try to actually solve this problem within something close to that time frame, it's going to take that kind of money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right now, the current plan is a 20-year plan.
Yeah, right. It's going to take a long time.
People are born and grow up and go all the way through school, and they're off to college by the time the plan is done.
Right.
I think we need to be a little bit more aggressive and a little bit more ambitious about what we're going to do to solve this problem.
Okay.
Partly because if we do it now, it's going to be less expensive than if we wait.
Sure. You're saying I hear you saying that the most important thing is to get revenue rapidly and spend it on a housing thing, and then you're proposing one seemingly plausible way to get that money that you think is a relatively progressive way to do so.
Yeah, and one that I think would be popular, one that I think the people of Portland would get on board with.
Right,
yeah.
That makes sense. Let's talk about transportation revenue then. There's gas tax on the ballot next to you. How are you going to vote on that?
I plan to vote for the gas tax.
Why is that?
I think it's unfortunately a declining source of revenue. I guess in some ways it's fortunate that it's a declining source of revenue because it means that it's because gas consumption is actually going down, which is a positive thing. But we need the money really badly, and we don't have another proposal on the ballot right now. So in the very short term, it's the only answer we have to get more revenue into the system, and we need more revenue.
Yeah.
You know, it has the potential to be regressive because it's taxing something that people at the low end of the income spectrum are going to be consuming more of proportionally. So to that extent, I'm not really a huge fan of taxes in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But it also kind of serves as an equivalent of a carbon tax in some ways, too, in terms of discouraging the use of fossil fuels. So on balance, I think it's a good way to go forward.
Yeah. So the proposal is to spend something like 50-odd percent on maintenance and 40-odd percent on safety improvements with the idea, I mean, obviously those are sort of artificial distinctions in some cases, but how do you feel about the sort of split of how that is spent, and how do we prioritize the needs to stop our roads from falling apart so that we have no money in the future versus improving our roads, which are failing right now?
So there's a lot of investment that's been deferred in our road system in terms of building new infrastructure, even in terms of maintaining our current infrastructure. Part of the whole logic of the raising more revenue for housing is we know that housing as a solution for a lot of our other problems actually is a really cost-effective thing. So it's actually going to free up money out of the rest of the budget that we're going to be able to spend on transit. So on top of the gas tax...
What, for example?
Well, if you're looking at, like, globally, I mean, you're adding $200 million to the budget, right, that's dedicated to affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
We may have other funding sources right now that we're stealing from to pay for housing or homelessness, right? We're, like, doing 5% budget cuts to all of the bureaus in the city to cover this. Well, we're not going to need to do that in the future because we're going to have dedicated funding for that purpose. So we're not going to be shuffling money around from other departments to pay for housing.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to have some more security in terms of one less need that's going to come in and raid that general fund money that can go towards streets. You know, and we also have, you know, other ways that we can create dedicated funding for streets. You know, we have system development charges and other things that we can use, you know, to supplement.
And we do.
But I think.
So you're saying those could be higher.
I'm saying there may be ways to tweak those to get a little bit more revenue in some places. But the biggest piece for me is that if you bring in that much revenue for housing, you're going to free up a lot of other resources that the city is using right now.
Okay. But 5% of the city transportation budget is not going to be the $100 million that the city says it needs to keep its roads from falling apart.
Certainly not.
Right. So, like, I think the gas tax brings in something like $18 million, and of which not all is put towards pavement maintenance. assuming that we do also need to stop people from dying at the rate they're dying on the street, you still got a big gap between 10 million or so and 100 million a year that would need to be spent. So we either need to find $90 million for transportation, or you need to plan to let some roads turn into gravel, which maybe is valid. I don't know. How do you come down on finding that additional $90 million or lowering our standards somehow?
Well, I think we need to find the money. $90 million is a big chunk to find. So we're going to have to look at a lot of different places to try to put it together. I think all the candidates are going to recognize that federal and state funding is going to have to be something that we look at to try to bring in as much of that as we can, because it's going to be hard to fund it all mm-hmm. at the local level. But I'm willing to look at creative solutions in terms of funding and where we can get that money from. I really think that... Like I'm saying, when we're developing, we're going to have a lot of new development going on in our city, and that's really the opportunity. Is when we're doing that, is to improve those resources. And
well, the SDCs are calculated based on the nexus, right? There's a legal formula, and they challenge it in the courts and so on every time they change it. And so how much wiggle room is there in that?
It's limited. Yeah, that's the thing. As I'm saying, we have to look at a lot of different small. Mm-hmm. places that we can make adjustments in order to really maximize our current sources, but we're probably going to have to look at something new, and I don't know what it's going to look like necessarily. Quite honestly, I'm still hearing from people what they think is a good solution for this, and I've heard a lot of different things. I've heard that people want to do it by raising rates on other services that the city provides, to kind of cross fund on that basis.
Mm-hmm. But your target would be to make it so that no streets become gravel.
Yeah, I don't want to see our infrastructure deteriorating. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, what I would like to see us focus more, though, on the types of safety investments that benefit the most vulnerable users, which right. are going to be our right. bicyclists and people who are walking.
Yeah, so let's talk about that.
I think that honestly, to me, in a lot of ways, is more important than dealing with some of the deferred maintenance on the streets, because that's really a fundamental thing. It's the most dangerous way to be on our roads is to not be in a car.
Sure. Yeah.
And it shouldn't be that way, because those are the modes that we want to prioritize and that we want to promote. We want people to be out there and be able to access our transit. Mm-hmm. That's the reason we've invested so much in this amazing transit system, is so that people will use it. And if we don't have a sidewalk or a bike lane that connects them to those systems, then we're failing
right.
as a city.
So that's weird. Then we're talking about more money to do that, right?
So it's going to be expensive.
Yeah. What's the... Do you have a vision of how you get to that? How much would you like to see folks spending on bike infrastructure? We talked about, I think the gas tax proposes, it's something like $3 million over 3 years for neighborhood greenways and $4 million for protected bike lanes over 4 years. And
which is a really, just a drop in the bucket. It's like a small piece of what we need.
Sure. So yeah. How much do we need?
Probably, I hate to just pull numbers out of
the
air.
Yeah, I'm not asking you to pull
numbers.
But I think
numbers. But I think that's, a small fraction of what we would need to invest in order to get the system that we want. I think I'm more focused on identifying the outcomes that we want to achieve and then kind of working back from that to sure. what do we need to make
so
that happen.
So what are the
outcomes? So that's the approach I took yeah. on housing, right? It's like we know how much we need to do to solve the housing problem. So I look at the infrastructure problem in the same way. How much do we need to spend to solve this problem? And then we look for ways to fund it. And quite honestly, I haven't gotten down to the nitty-gritty on the funding on the transport side
sure.
to the same extent. And some of that is because it's an unknown at the state level right now. Because funding at the state level, there's this huge ballot measure on the block right now. Not knowing what's going to happen with that, it's really hard to know where things
are going
to shake out.
You're talking about the 2017 session?
Yeah. Well, and we have there's a big ballot measure that the unions are putting together to tax corporations that's going to be on the ballot this fall. And that's going to be a big factor in what the state can do.
Okay.
And that's mm-hmm. going to factor in to what the city needs to do and where the city's resources are going to have to be directed.
Right.
Because it's going to be a balance.
My impression is that
things.
That ballot measure would not go to transportation at all, but I could be wrong. It might be that some of that is carved off for the non-road transportation stuff, because they can't use the gas tax on non-road stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then there are some other sources. There's, I understand there's some county money
mm-hmm.
that is available that has kind of been shifted back and forth from different uses.
I'm not aware of that.
That had been used for some bike and walking infrastructure and then had been reallocated to do some freight infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, when we have opportunities like that, if we can focus more on the bicycle and walking.
You might be talking about Metro?
That's right, that's Metro, yeah.
Okay, great. So there's a talk conversation right now about
a $40 million chunk or something.
Yeah, exactly. There's a Metro, that's federal money, it goes through Metro, and some of that goes to 25% of a one part of that goes to Brain.
Yeah, I understand that was the formula they were using. But now there's a bunch more federal money in the latest bill, I understand, for freight. So I could see 100% for bike and walking out of that. I would like to see that shifted because it makes sense.
Right.
You know, because we don't need it. Well, because, if we're getting that much more money from the feds, $80 million, I think it was, for freight.
Not sure exactly.
I don't see why we want to continue to spend this money where we have the discretion not to spend it on that. Mm-hmm. Spend it on the best modes that we have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and biking and walking are the best modes we have.
Why is that?
The lowest impact. Carbon impact is minimal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's nothing that's more efficient.
Yeah.
Great. You know, and the impact it has on the infrastructure, too. I mean, infrastructure for bicycling and walking lasts longer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm still walking on 100-year-old sidewalks in my neighborhood.
Right.
But that street that I'm walking right next to has probably been repaved 20 times.
Right.
You know?
Yep, that's true. Do you think it's possible to make biking walking improvements without substantially making it substantially more annoying to drive around? And if so, is that okay?
I think there are going to be some places where it's more annoying to drive, and I do think that's okay. I mean, there's a new bike diverter in my neighborhood that went in the last few months along Clinton. I live right near the bike corridor there on Clinton, and it's great.
Yeah.
I don't take the same route that I used to drive. I have to turn on specific streets to get to my mm-hmm. house from certain directions, but I'm totally fine with that
mm-hmm.
because I see the manifest improvement in the conditions for bicyclists on that street, and I know how important that arterial is for people who are commuting
mm-hmm.
in and out of downtown Portland. It's a very good trade-off.
Yeah, fair enough. Great.
You know, and it's making the best use of our existing infrastructure. I think that's another thing that we need to be conscious of, is we have a lot of streets that we spend a lot of money on,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of them aren't really getting utilized that much.
Yeah.
You know, and if we're more creative about where we direct traffic and how we allocate traffic onto the different arterials that we do have, I think we can make a lot of good use of what we do have without actually totally inconveniencing people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, there's going to be some places where it's going to slow the system down.
Yeah, great.
But the more that motivates people to get in transit and get on bikes and walk around, then we're achieving our purpose.
Yeah, cool. There's a question of where to spend money on infrastructure, right? Or you just where to do infrastructure. You've got a trade-off between the central city, which is already pretty nice,
mm-hmm.
But also where there is the highest potential for further growth in non-automotive travel.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the east and southwest, which are not that nice to bike in or walk in. And a lot more money could be spent, and you might not get the same number of people shifting modes as a result, but you would certainly be benefiting a larger percentage of the population that currently has no access to good biking or walking, right?
Yeah, and my thought is that we need to set kind of a basic standard, that everybody in Portland is paying into this community on the same basis, that we all should expect at least like a basic standard within our neighborhoods for
mm-hmm.
infrastructure.
Yeah.
And so I think that means that we need to make the investment in East Portland that we have not been making for the last 30 years. People have been moving out there, and you know, part of the reason it's more affordable out there is because we haven't spent as much money on this type of investment, but it's a safety thing. And East Portland is where the safety problems are the worst.
Mm-hmm.
So it's obviously where the investment needs to be focused.
Yeah. How do you decide? Does that mean that all 100% of? I mean, it makes sense to say that's where the investment needs to be focused. We've deferred lots of obligations to East Portland over the years. We should spend everything we've got in transportation to make East Portland better.
I don't think we can spend all of our transportation dollars in East Portland. I think it's obvious we're going to have to spend some money to keep up our system all across the city.
For sure, but all our improvements.
But I think we should focus our improvements. I think the vast majority of the improvements need to be focused on the areas that don't have those basic things.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have sidewalks and you don't have bike lanes, then you don't really have a neighborhood that meets the livability standards that Portlanders expect.
Right. And that would be, even if that means that we don't, that it's still annoying to bike down Broadway for 10 years through downtown, that's okay. People can deal with it because it's worse somewhere else.
Well, I mean, in terms of the central city, I think there are some really important connection difficulties that we do need to prioritize partly because it is a safety issue. You know, these are other mm-hmm. safety hotspots where it's really tough for people to connect their routes. And, you know, I can think of a few areas where we could, you know, make those connections. I think Broadway is an example. There's some areas on the inner southwest around Barber Boulevard and Terwilliger that could be, you know, done with better. But, yeah, I think the vast majority of the improvements really do need to be out in the periphery of the city, because we do have actually a pretty decent basic infrastructure in the inner part of the city.
Yeah, you know. That's true.
Yeah. And we've actually invested a lot even in the inner part of Southeast. I mean, we've got all kinds of new, you know, bike, you know, like wetland swale areas and, you know, curb bump outs and all kinds of stuff like that. You know, I'm seeing, you know, perfectly good sidewalks torn up to put ramps in my neighborhood when lots of my neighbors that are, you know, 60 or 80 blocks farther out of town don't actually have a sidewalk.
Right.
And don't have a bike lane.
Right.
And, you know, they, you know, don't have really a good way to get into town, right, other than driving in some cases, which is really unfortunate.
Yeah. I keep forgetting to talk about bike recreation, so I don't want to give it short shrift. Let's talk about that a little bit. Do you have any thoughts on the mountain biking opportunities for new single track in the city, or other sort of off-road recreational opportunities in parks?
Yeah, I mean, I enjoy mountain biking in town. I like having access to it. I mean, I wish we had a little bit more.
Do you have any thoughts on where that could happen? What's possible? How do you?
I mean,
how do you get people to, you know? How do you navigate the problem of people having conflicts between walking and biking and trails?
Well, I mean, part of it is, you know, that you have to balance the different users, right? And single track mountain biking is not going to be compatible with some other uses. Mm-hmm. So having some designated trails for that purpose, I think, is really important. But really, the biggest areas we have, I mean, we have Powell Butte and we have Forest Park, and those are like the big open areas that are the main opportunities for that kind of biking.
Yeah. You know,
it would be neat to see mountain biking in other parts of town, but that just isn't possible.
Sure.
But I think we need to make sure that we keep that available for people as close to town as possible. I don't think we want to force people to actually have to get into a car to go somewhere to get on their bike. I think that's silly.
Right.
If we can make accessible mountain biking opportunities happen close to the city, we need to do that.
Have you been following the Riverview Natural Area conversation? This is just on the west side of the river. There's an area that was purchased with money that was maybe not supposed to be spent on parks and is being spent on parks.
Yeah, there's something like with the Water Bureau.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah, that sounds familiar. I don't know that I know all the details of it, though.
There was a plan made to put some biking trails there because you wouldn't be taking anything away from anybody, and then that has been stymied by the fact that they're not allowed to develop it to be used as parkland.
Yeah. So I think, you know, there are ways that the city can change those things.
Yeah.
You know, the city has the potential to transfer some properties or come to agreements between different agencies. There are some rules that are pretty hard and fast about how some of the properties can be used that are, unfortunately, maybe not negotiable.
Sure. Great. Let's a little bit more about the Central City. One of the questions before the Portland Development Commission in the next mayor's term is going to be where does the money come from for the PDC after the urban renewal districts expire? Do you think the PDC should continue to exist? Should it be looking for new revenue sources? And specifically, there's talk about building parking garages in the Central East Side and Old Town that would use some of those tax increment dollars and then be theoretically become revenue generating, and then the PDC could fund its operations through the sale of those parking spaces.
I don't like the idea of the PDC funding itself by parking for single occupancy vehicles.
Why is that?
It just seems like a perverse incentive for them to keep single occupancy vehicles coming into the city, which is against a lot of the long-term plans that the city has.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to reduce that type of usage.
Could you imagine a scenario where you would support that, or where that would be a good idea?
It's hard to see how you could justify using parking as your funding mechanism for PDC. I mean, there might be an argument that could be made if the parking incentives are right, but I don't see building new parking as the solution to funding an agency like that. It just seems counterproductive
in the
short and the long term.
Fair. So, let's, out of curiosity, how do you see the future of the urban renewal areas or the PDC?
Well, it's a powerful tool to use the urban renewal districts, you know, and but the problem is that it focuses the development in a really bad way, and it causes really, really intense gentrification that pushes people out of these neighborhoods, and it restricts the kind of development that we can do in the rest of the city.
Sure.
So I'm not really necessarily excited about losing some of the tools that we have with the urban renewal districts, but if it allows us to develop in a more equitable way, to do away with it, maybe that's a better way to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. The parking conversation in general, which is tied to the housing conversation to some extent, there's the city's maybe about to roll out a thing for neighborhoods where they can put in parking permits in certain areas, so you'd have the give a neighborhood the option to vote on creating a parking district, and they would get a little bit of the money, and the city would get a little bit of the money to do the enforcement. And basically, if you live on one of the main streets, you wouldn't be allowed to park in the residential areas. The idea is that this reduces the demand for people to block new commercial housing developments on the streets, on the larger streets.
Because you're preserving their access to parking.
You're preserving access to parking in the single-family area. What do you think about that whole scheme? I don't know. Have you any thoughts on any of these issues?
Well, I know that there's two sides to it, obviously, when it comes to the parking stuff. I mean, some folks, it's going to be a really big cost burden, and they don't have a lifestyle that allows them to live without a car. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of folks can't get around on the transit system. Our transit system doesn't provide really comprehensive access for everybody.
Right. So you mean the cost of the $20 a year permit or whatever is going to be really big cost burden? Or could I don't know how much it's going to be.
But that's the thing with the parking is my understanding is that the actual permit charges could get pretty steep pretty fast.
Okay.
So, yeah, I think ultimately we do need to think about how we're going to manage our parking in the long term, and particularly if we're not going to be building new parking, we have to think about how we're going to make parking to access equitable for folks. Mm-hmm. But part of the problem with what we're going to be doing with this system is increasing the charge of parking is going to disproportionately affect the people who are at the lowest end of the income distribution.
Right.
So I support the idea of rationing parking and keeping it regulated in a way that gives people access to it in their neighborhood, but I'd also like to make sure that we don't do it in a way that prices people out of their neighborhood.
So what would that be?
It may be just based on income. There may be, you know, some kind of sliding scale. You know, maybe it isn't a flat fee for a parking spot in the neighborhood. Maybe it's based on the ability to pay. Mm-hmm. You know, and maybe that's not the best compromise. I don't know, but I think that we don't want to be doing things that force people out of their neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
if we can avoid it, anything that is going to raise costs at a rate that's going to exceed people's ability to pay is something that we need to look at carefully.
Right. Okay, great. So on that question then, where do you come down on the role of housing supply in housing prices?
Well, obviously we're short on the housing that is demanded. People are moving to Portland in great numbers, and we don't have enough places for them to move into.
Mm-hmm.
You know, vacancies are very, very low. Inventory in our housing market is very, very low.
Mm-hmm.
So we need more housing. But the problem is the way that we've been building more housing historically has not provided enough housing that's actually affordable to the people that live here. So now we've built a bunch of housing that's vacant, that's so expensive that nobody in Portland wants to rent it.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time that we have thousands of people sleeping in doorways on our streets just a block or two away.
Right.
It's a very, very perverse situation for our city to be in, to have allowed this to happen.
So what caused that to happen, do you think?
What's happened is that we basically subsidize developers. That's been our plan for building affordable housing, has been to subsidize developers to create some small proportion of affordable housing, which is never going to be enough to keep up with the demand for housing in that range.
Mm-hmm.
We know that there are a lot of people that are making less than the median income.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it's the median.
Right.
Most,
you know, half of us.
Half right. of us are not exceeding the median income.
Right.
So there's a lot of people that are in that 0 to 30 MFI or 30 to 50 MFI that cannot find a place to live in Portland.
Right. So what are they doing?
So they're doubling up with people.
Mm-hmm.
Some folks have been evicted. You know, some folks are bouncing from one situation to another. A lot of folks have left to the suburbs. They're living, you know, in communities that surround Portland.
Right.
You know, which is, you know, makes solving the problem more complicated because it's hard to coordinate with Portland and the other city governments when you're trying to solve this problem. But I think Portland has to kind of take the lead when it comes down to it in terms of the affordable housing issue because we have the bulk of the population density.
Mm-hmm.
And we have all the services that people need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. So, you don't want to subsidize developers. what's inherently wrong about subsidizing developers? If you were providing them with enough of a subsidy to create all the affordable housing you needed, wouldn't that solve the problem?
Well, part of the problem is the ownership problem. Mm-hmm. You know, the ownership of property in Portland, when it is not held by people in Portland, and it's not held by the people that are actually residing in the residences, mm-hmm. becomes a source of income for other people. It becomes a profit center for people.
Right.
And we've seen what happens with that. There's speculation that goes on that drives the prices up at a very extreme rate, particularly when the demand is high like it is right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we allow that to continue, if we allow the market forces to take their course, we know what that looks like. We've seen what happens in Seattle and in San Francisco when you don't take adequate preventative action.
Mm-hmm.
The rents will continue to rise.
When you don't take adequate preventative action of what?
In terms of
what sort?
Doing something other than just letting the market determine the rates for housing in your city.
Okay.
And so for me, that means we need to invest in community-owned housing.
Mm-hmm.
We need to take some housing stock out of the market so that people can't speculate on it, so that we actually have the ability to ration that resource.
Sure.
You know, it's a basic resource. You know, we have some basic things that we provide as a city for our citizens. You know, we provide water for people, and we provide streets for people, and we provide public safety for people. Most of those things are meaningless without housing.
Right.
And it's becoming more and more recognized, I think, that housing is a basic need,
mm-hmm.
and that it's really a human right.
Mm-hmm.
And that a lot of the policies that the city has pursued in the past have been violative of human rights.
So what would so they're community-owned, funded by new revenue, and this is... Is your concern about the privately owned affordable housing, the privately owned subsidized housing, I should say, that it is more expensive, or that it's just a political problem to
there's
have?
There's a problem that it's...
speculation, I'm not sure how that fits in.
There's a problem that it's more expensive. There's a problem that, for the most part, it's on a time-limited basis, so mm-hmm. it's affordable, but only for so long.
Mm-hmm.
Which means that we're basically setting a time bomb of affordability that's going to go off in the future.
Well, I would always rather pay $400 a month than $800 a month, right? So,
sure.
Yeah.
But we have some ideas about what is fair or what is reasonable for people to pay for rent. I mean, we have guidelines about what proportion of people's income should be going to housing.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people in our city are going way beyond that
sure,
proportion
absolutely.
Because the cost has gone up so fast and their incomes have not.
Mm-hmm.
And if we... do it as a community, and if we build it in as a long-term investment, what we're doing is we're actually changing the dynamic in the market, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you have more of a proportion of affordable housing, then the pressure for people to pay more than they need to for housing is reduced.
For however many people we can afford to
put housing. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, but not everybody is going to need some kind of subsidy, either. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really the focus is on folks that are not making the medium income.
Mm-hmm.
Or more. You know, folks that are making the medium income or above, for the most part, are surviving. They're still under stress, but they're not in the same level of risk that folks are of losing their housing.
Right.
Which is really a significant problem right now.
What percentage of the population would you ideally like to see in public housing?
Well, I think part of it is we have to measure the outcomes and measure, you know, our success.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you look, you know, around the world, it's not unreasonable to want to see 15 to 20% of our housing stock be held mm-hmm. by the public. But part of the idea with my community housing initiative is not just to like hit a set number,
mm-hmm.
but it's really to create a means to expand that over time, because we're probably not going to get to 15% right away, right? We're going to have to start small, but I don't think we want to limit ourselves either by saying, well, we only need 20% affordable. I mean, if we get to 20% and there's still more need for affordable housing, I don't see why the city shouldn't continue to invest, particularly if we're finding that we can successfully control the cost of housing
mm-hmm.
and keep people from being displaced from our city. You know, there's a lot of places around the world where they've made a significant investment in public housing
mm-hmm.
and quite successfully. It's a very cost-effective way to pool resources to allow the community to stay intact. Because if we don't do that, if we allow ourselves to be, you know, taken out one by one, mm-hmm. we will. We'll all be displaced one by one from our city and be replaced by people who are more wealthy, that are coming from other cities, to take advantage of the fact that the cost of living here is low and we have a beautiful city that we've built.
Right.
And it would just be a shame if all the work that Portlanders put into building this beautiful city
yep.
were put to waste because we couldn't live here or afford to live
here
anymore.
Well, it wouldn't be put to waste. It would just be given to rich people.
We'd be handing it off. Yeah, we'd be handing it off to a completely different set of people that didn't make that investment themselves.
That's true.
That doesn't seem fair.
That makes sense. So, so I think that is a I feel like that's a coherent plausible scenario that would improve housing for the poorest, 10 to 30% or so of
and it's not like a one-size-fits-all kind of thing. Yeah. I mean, there's different pieces within this program. I mean, I've also talked about, you know, land trusts as part of it, too.
Right.
This is something that is popularized up in Burlington, Vermont by Bernie Sanders,
mm-hmm.
is creating, housing land trusts so that the land stays and is only used for affordable housing, but people can make an investment in the actual structure. You know, it actually reminds me of some of the real estate techniques that the Chinese have used, in terms of the government actually retains ownership of all real estate in China,
mm-hmm.
and then leases it out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this would not necessarily be that same kind of model, but it basically is giving the city the control over how these resources are used.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's one of the most important things in our community is our housing stock.
Right.
And if the city doesn't do this, we know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We've seen it.
Right. Yeah, well, so and that makes sense. I guess I also want to talk about the people at the median, right? So those people are also paying more for housing than they would like. Certainly many people are paying more than 30% or whatever. Are there other things we can do to increase affordable proximity for folks who are middle class?
Yeah, part of it is allowing for appropriate types of infill development, mm-hmm. that increase density, because if we increase density, then we lower the cost per unit. We know that works.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I live in a type of apartment complex that I don't believe could actually be built right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like a sixplex.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
It'd be very hard to put on. We don't have the zoning for it right now.
Yeah.
So we need to reform our zoning to allow for things like that to be built again, because those are really efficient way to get some more infill development without radically changing neighborhoods. It's stuff that neighbors are going to be able to accept in their neighborhoods.
In an R5 zone, it's okay to have a sixplex across the street. You think people won't be upset about that?
Well, the R5 folks might, but I think, you know, there are still areas where we have R2 and R1 zoning that we're not seeing that kind of stuff yet.
Right. Why do you suppose that is? You could do that in a R1.
Yeah, and in some places we will start to see more of that.
But it's not happening yet, and we've got a problem right now.
Part of it is that the incentive's not there.
Yeah.
You know, the only thing that's driving development in our city right now is really the profit motive.
Right.
And profit motive doesn't really care about how many people are getting housed on the lot. It cares about how many dollars can we extract from this limited piece of property.
Right.
And
sometimes
that's going to dictate that a single family 3,000-foot home is built there instead of a multiplex,
mm-hmm.
because they're going to make more profit on it.
Right. So I guess I'm asking, is there a way to give a profit motive to housing more people than
yes,
there currently is?
There definitely is. There's definitely ways that we can change our fee structure and that we can change our approval process to incentivize building that type of thing.
Okay.
You know, part of it is we don't have to charge the full freight on all of our development charges. We can, you know, negotiate on some of that in order to incentivize more of the multi-unit development.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, I mean, some of it's going to have to be done by the city, too.
Sure. Okay. Great. Let's talk about policing a bit. There are numbers from the Portland Police Bureau show that if you're a Portlander of color who is walking and biking, you are even more likely to be stopped by somebody in uniform than if you're driving. So it creates a sense of not being welcome in a community when that happens. What can we do about that?
Well, it's a long-term, long-standing problem, and it's going to require some time to fix it, but part of it is that we got to change basically the whole idea of how we interact with the community. The police officers in our community, although they try really hard, they're not succeeding in building those relationships right now in a lot of places within our city.
Mm-hmm.
And it's borne out in the county statistics. We've seen it, you know, 4 or 5, 6 times more likely to be having to deal with the police if you're a minority, and it's totally inappropriate.
Right.
So part of it's going to be that we need, I think, honestly, more diversity in leadership in our police force.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I haven't had a chance to really sit down with the police department and kind of go through the paces on this, but from what I understand, there's a lot of room for improvement in terms of the diversity of our police force and the representation of our communities on mm-hmm. our police force. We have a lot of police that don't live in our communities,
mm-hmm.
and I think we need to work on getting more people that are in the communities they're policing to be on our force.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're having trouble recruiting folks right now, and you know, it's a very complicated situation. Our police force has gotten to a point where the relationship with the community is very strained, and there are just some ongoing issues that have to do with the contract and the policies that are in place that are desperately in need of help. And, you know, that's something that I'm willing to do some hard work on. I'm willing to push really hard to make sure that our police union contract gives the city the power it needs to effectively reform this police force. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a really high priority for me, and it's something that, you know, I come with some experience looking at this issue. I've worked with the ACLU, and I've looked at, you know, the criminal justice issues and the disparities, and I've worked with the Oregon Justice Resource Center, which is sort of like a big advocate on these issues. It's just really, it's a systemic problem. It's a nationwide problem, but here in Portland, we actually can do something about it.
What are some key things you would want to introduce into the contract, and what would you be able to give in exchange for them?
So we know we need to get rid of the 48-hour rule.
Mm-hmm.
We know that
This is the rule that says you don't have to tell the story about what
happened. Yeah, this is the rule that allows police officers not to testify about what happened
when
in a police-involved shooting.
Right.
Yeah, when they killed someone on our behalf.
Right.
You know? And that's a process that we need to change. There's no reason that they should be waiting 2 days. You know, we know that that's not good for getting an accurate report.
Okay.
You know, we need to focus on transparency and accuracy, because that's how we're going to rebuild trust.
So how do you get that out of the contract if that's something they're asking for?
Well, we have to look at what else can we give them, right?
Mm-hmm.
What else can we offer? So it may come down to some other incentives that need to be in place. You know, maybe we need to pay more. Maybe that's part of the problem that we're having to recruit police. Maybe the compensation just isn't enough for the job that we're asking them
to do. That's the usual system.
You know, I mean, we're asking them to do a really, really tough job.
Mm-hmm.
There are people leaving our police force to go work in other enforcement agencies because enforcing the laws in Portland is tough.
Mm-hmm.
Like any big city, it gets more complicated. When you have more people in a smaller space, the issues just get a little more intense.
That makes sense.
You know, and Our police force is also tasked with doing a lot of things that aren't really appropriate for a police force to have to be doing, which does not help with community relations. You know, when the police are tasked with going out and rousting people out of sleeping on the street because they have no other place to sleep, that is deteriorating the relationship between those people and the police. And for a lot of people that are in the community that are sympathetic to folks that are sleeping on the street see that, it also affects their impression of the police.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact is most of our police are trying really, really hard to do a really good job and are succeeding. But unfortunately, we know from the statistics that there is a proportion of our officers that are actually contributing disproportionately to that kind of discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, that's where the transparency and the information, the more granular information we can get about what is actually happening on the streets and what kind of discriminatory activities are going on, the better chance we're going to have of pushing back and getting rid of those behaviors. And some of it is just particular officers,
mm-hmm.
to be honest. You know, when you get down to the granular level, there's some officers that are doing this. And it's a small percentage that are doing most of the discriminatory enforcement.
Right.
You know. But collecting that information is very tough if you don't have those policies in place from the beginning. So that's why you have to look at, when we're negotiating the contract, when we're putting policies in place, we have to build a system that allows us to get that information so that we actually can respond appropriately. Because right now we're basically blind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got this report that tells us kind of broad statistical information. But honestly, the police force itself needs to be proactively collecting that information for its own benefit.
Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't be doing it as kind of an after-the-fact reporting thing where they're like, would rather not actually even tell anybody about it, which is what it feels like when you see what's happening at the county level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it seems like the sheriff would rather that this information didn't get out,
mm-hmm.
when really the reality is this is really important stuff that they need to be talking about, and they need to be communicating with the community. And that's the ultimate problem, is they haven't been communicating. And even when it comes down to getting called out about it, they're trying to avoid accountability.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be tough. It's going to be a really tough contract negotiation with the police union.
Yeah, right.
But that's what happens when you leave things for too long.
Right.
You make it tougher for the next people that come in to fix it.
Yeah. Just briefly, I want to talk a little bit about national policy. I think you identify as Democratic Socialist? Or Social Democrat?
Yeah, I think it's fair to put me in either of the or both of those categories, I guess. I mean, there's a lot of conflict about definitions, but...
Yeah, how would you define your ideology?
I believe that we need to make some basic investments in our community in order to be successful as a representative democracy.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, if we're going to have this project succeed of having shared governance, that we need to recognize that we all have some basic needs, and that we need to work together to make sure those are satisfied. And I think you know,
things
like
healthcare. That's already the consensus.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the consensus around the world, but I think, you know, in a lot of ways, our nation is behind times on a lot of these issues. Mm-hmm. You know, we are making progress in terms of universal access to healthcare, but it's still an imperfect system here with a lot of room for improvement. You know, we don't have any kind of real access to housing that's guaranteed. Mm-hmm. You know, people are just kind of on their own to find a place to live. And, you know, to a certain extent, that's part of the American spirit of freedom and innovation. But in the past, we used to have the opportunity for people to homestead. Mm-hmm. You know, there was kind of this open range of options. And those options aren't there.
Right. Yeah.
And we need to recognize that that changed situation and adjust our policies accordingly, I think.
Yeah, okay. You mentioned you're a fan of Sanders. One thing that I've just personally have been wishing that Sanders would talk about, what I think of as urban issues about like the use of space. He doesn't talk about the urban form. He doesn't talk about sort of space on the streets, the justice of using space for cars versus other means.
Given my little bit of traveling around the U.S., I would say it's probably just because he's from Vermont, right, and they don't have a big city.
That's fair. Yeah, I don't mean to single him out,
but
I'm
saying
say,
like in terms of his rhetoric, like that's not part of his normal routine because it doesn't fit his normal representation.
Right.
He's usually representing Vermont, and there isn't a city like that
right.
in Vermont.
Well, but so
Burlington
is
great for its scale, but there's nothing that
right for sure.
out there.
yeah, but Burlington was built on like a different set of urbanism principles than we have today that are in place of requiring priority of automobiles. And so I guess what I'm asking is like as somebody who's thinking about himself as part of a national movement to some extent, what does it take to get urbanism into the sort of the progressive conversation nationally, do you think?
Well, I think the opportunity right now is probably around the housing piece.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's where a lot of the development, a lot of the investment is going to be going in the future.
Yeah.
Particularly in the near-term future, we have since there was such a backlog in building housing during the economic crunch that now the demand is really, really high, we're going to be building a lot of housing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an opportunity for us. To focus on these issues and to kind of air it out. But only if we get the chance to have that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's part of what I'm trying to do, talking about affordable housing and talking about investing in community-owned housing, is to try to start to have that conversation in a more serious way, yeah. at the local level at least. I'd love to see it at the national level, but honestly, it's a city-by-city thing. It really, most of this action is going to happen at the city level.
Right.
You know,
that's a big reversal from what it used to be like in the 60s. Like HUD was created to do this, and then it had a bunch of publicized failures, or maybe they weren't actually failures, but there was received wisdom is that there was a bunch of HUD failures.
I think that there were a lot of people that had vested interest in HUD being perceived as a failure,
right?
Regardless of whether it actually was a failure across the board or not. And I don't think I don't think we want to necessarily follow a past model in terms of like using HUD as our example. I think part of the political process in the U.S. has always been about local experimentation, about trying things out, and then what works kind of gets adopted broadly because we have a system that allows us to do that. So I think Portland should take the opportunity to lead the way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we wait for the federal government to do it, it might never happen.
Yeah.
And I think if we lead the way, I think that we can set a good example for the federal government in terms of what kind of investments to make.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts on communicating, this is back to transportation for a bit, but like communicating the idea of a transition to a lower car society. So Foster Road is a good example where it's about to go through a road diet, and so it's supposed to make it much safer, add a few minutes of traffic delay,
mm-hmm.
Add bike lanes on parts of the street, but they're not going to be great. It's going to become much easier to walk across the street, or much safer anyway.
Mm-hmm.
There's a developing backlash. The city, to my knowledge, isn't doing anything about that backlash at the moment. What can we do as a community to help people understand a project like Foster Road?
In terms of getting more community support?
Yeah, how can we, right.
Well, I think that goes back to like one of the very first things we were talking about, the neighborhoods. I think before we actually started recording, we were talking about the 95 different neighborhoods in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a tool to get that kind of buy-in, is to use that neighborhood association as the conduit for information to make sure that there's communication back and forth with the city before the plans are actually put into print and put into stone eventually. Right. You know, we need to have that on the front end. We need to get the buy-in from the community.
If the furniture store salesman doesn't go to the neighborhood association meeting and he gets angry about something, what do you do about him?
Well, I think that's part of the responsibility of the neighborhood association to communicate with the folks in the community, but it's also the city's responsibility to make sure they have the resources to do that effectively. So one thing that we're not really using very effectively right now that we honestly should be doing a lot better job with is technology.
Mm-hmm.
We have the technology, we have the tools to be collecting a lot more information from the neighborhoods and from the people in the neighborhoods about what they actually want.
Hmm.
But now, I mean, even we could go as far as, you know, just having direct input from people on these issues on our website at the city level. You know, I mean, I could see the city developing an app that is like, you know, a one-stop shop for city services where, you know, you can report a pothole, mm-hmm. or you can apply for a development permit, or you can find out what's happening in your neighborhood, mm-hmm. you know, and using geolocation, you know, like really, we have all of these tools,
mm-hmm.
all of this technology and all of this information, but right now it's just not connected.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we give people more of an opportunity to interact and more tools to interact, more ways to interact, if it isn't just they have to come to the meeting.
Right.
If that's the only access that they have to city government to have an influence on what's happening in their neighborhood, then it's the city government that's failing. You can't blame the people in the neighborhood.
Okay. So that message is received then. What is the message? How do you frame the message when you're talking about these benefits to the people who receive this message through the app or the meeting or whatever?
So ultimately what it's about is that you're going to be improving the environment for everybody. And it's a matter of helping them see how the improvement is going to benefit them. So it's going to be different for each user. Every user has a different interest in the infrastructure and in kind of the landscape that's being created there. So folks that are worried that the 3-minute delay is going to be a big issue, I mean, first of all, you can show them that, you know, people are not going to take an alternate route because there isn't an alternate route. The delay is so small that it isn't really going to impact people's traffic choices in terms of what route they're taking. And also just people are going to be in their neighborhood more. If it's a friendlier neighborhood, if it's a better neighborhood for walking, for biking, then there's going to be more people in the neighborhood. And I think the statistics show that people that are walking and biking are going to spend more money in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So they're actually better customers. For like the businesses that might be worried that they need this car traffic coming through to feed their business, you can actually show them by the numbers that they're actually going to make more money.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for a lot of folks, that's going to be the bottom line. If it's going to benefit their business, then they don't really have an objection.
Right.
But sometimes it's just ignorance. People just haven't been educated about what the impact really is going to be.
Sure.
You know, and to a certain extent, we don't always know exactly what the impact is going to be. But we can look at the statistics, we can look at, you know, in general, what happens when we do this type of work, and we've seen that it improves outcomes in the neighborhood for everybody.
Yeah. What is the thing about, what belief do you have that you fear is wrong? What is a belief that is something about policy that you think is true, but might not be true, and you sometimes worry that you're wrong about it?
About policy or about politics, I guess?
No, politics is fine. It's something relevant to the election.
I guess I worry that the folks that are running don't understand necessarily what they're talking about.
Hmm.
That they've got good rhetoric, but that they don't necessarily understand the impact that it's having on people's lives.
Hmm.
That concerns me.
For example?
Well, and when we talk about, like, the housing issue, you know, when people talk about it as something where the market is going to fix the problem, and I don't think they're understanding, you know, I don't think they're really comprehending
mm-hmm.
the nature of the problem.
Who says that? I feel like Bailey has come the closest to saying that in our interviews.
Yeah, I'd say Bailey is probably the most squarely in that
uh-huh.
in that region. But
even he's saying that, he actually, that was his answer to that question, was he's afraid that maybe the market is not going to be enough to solve the problem.
Yeah, so I guess I'm seeing that people are trying to rely on the market too much to
mm-hmm.
solve this problem,
yeah.
and without understanding how that doesn't work,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's particularly dismaying, I guess, because we've got folks that are trained as economists
mm-hmm.
that aren't seeing what's really actually pretty obvious in terms of how the financing for our affordable housing works and in terms of the proportion of affordable housing that we're building.
And to be clear, the way you're saying that the market is failing, is it for those people on the bottom end of the income ladder?
Yeah, essentially, because, there isn't the profit motive to serve people at the low end of the income spectrum.
Right. Yeah, spectrum, thank you. Okay, great.
So expecting the market to fix a problem that is a market-created problem,
mm-hmm.
that concerns me. And that concerns me that, and I also see just, like, kind of a focus on maybe aspirations without a lot of pathway to get there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm guilty of that to a certain extent myself, obviously. That's part of what being aspirational in politics is about. You have to set a goal, mm-hmm. and maybe you don't know exactly how you're going to get there. Mm-hmm. But I think people at least need to make the effort to think about, how is there a logical way to get there?
Sure.
And can we figure out what some of the steps are? You know, because it's great to have aspirations. It's great to say, oh, well, we're going to be the most livable city on the planet, as mm-hmm. Sarah wants to say.
Right.
Okay, well, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. Because the most livable city may mean a different thing to every single different person in our city.
Oh, it probably does.
Yeah. So to say that is great, but if you don't define it, if you don't actually talk about what that means, it's just pretty words, and it's not actually going to get us anywhere.
That's
what I am most concerned about, is that we're going to hear
right.
a lot of really good talk over the course of the election.
Uh-huh.
And that's part of why I'm in the race, is to push the conversation.
Right.
But if it's only the conversation and the policy doesn't change, then we're screwed.
And you're saying, and because you you said this in response to my question about what you think, but might be wrong, you're saying you actually think that Sarah and Jules do not have that problem, but you fear that they may.
Yeah. I'm scared.
I'm suspicious that you actually think that they don't have that problem.
I don't know them well enough to know what's in their head, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like they haven't got there yet in terms of telling us what we need to hear to understand what they're going to do with the city.
Okay, well, that's fair.
Where they're going to take Portland. They're kind of talking about a really abstract future
mm-hmm.
in some ways, or they're talking about using the same tools that we've been using and getting different outcomes.
Right.
And those things just don't compute to me.
Okay, yeah, that's fair. And I think it's totally fine to talk about, you know, possible shortcomings with your opponents. But let's take it back to you. I do want to know something that you actually think, that you do fully believe, but you also think might be wrong.
Well, I fully believe that the people of Portland want to invest in their community and in the type of housing that I'm talking about, that they
mm-hmm.
actually want to look at a solution that doesn't depend on the market and that they're willing to fund it.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that the people of Portland are willing to put into place a new revenue source dedicated to that.
Right.
And if I'm wrong about that, then my whole campaign is totally
yeah.
off course, right? Because
right.
that's my central plank. Like, that's what I'm focused on, and I
sure.
really am passionate.
You're testing that question.
And I believe that that's really important. And I think, you know, I think given what's happening in our community, it is really pretty much the most important question that we can answer. You know, is that an investment that Portland is willing to make? And I think the answer is yes. I think Portland's willing to make that investment. Now, Portland might not be ready to make that investment. That's entirely possible. And if I'm not elected, that may be a sign that Portland isn't ready.
Right.
But that it may not even mean that that's not the solution. It just may mean that Portland's not ready yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's definitely some folks in Portland that are very ready for it. It's just a matter of whether people have come around to believe at the majority that that is the way forward.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll make the argument on the economics of it, and I'll make the argument on just the morality of it. And, you know, if people can't get on board, then I'll just have to keep making the case. But I think that the reality is there isn't a better option that anyone is proposing right now. I feel like I put together the best program to deal with the most important problem in our city right now that I've seen proposed. And it's not set in stone. I'm still taking input on a daily basis. You know, I'm really interested in harnessing the creativity and the intelligence of our community. Portland is an incredibly educated, thoughtful, and, you know, well-versed community when it comes to these types of problems. We have all of the answers here in town, but we need people who are willing to listen and to actually put those things into practice and to have this conversation before it's too late, to talk about it during the election and actually get it out on the table.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned you'd like to do mountain biking. Where was your last bike ride of any sort?
Well, honestly, the mountain biking hasn't been the biggest thing lately. The snowboarding is my...
Mm, yeah.
I actually get paid to snowboard sometimes. So
how does that work?
I work for Mounted Meadows, and I do conditions reporting for them.
Okay.
So sometimes part of that job...
Yeah, just have to get to a certain spot by a snowboard.
Yeah, well, or it's just...
Oh, you're testing it.
I would actually... they call it testing the conditions,
right?
If they're testing the product.
Great.
You know, so.
Right.
If I'm going to tell people what to expect when they get out on the mountain, it's important that I get out there and
right.
see what's actually happening.
Sweet.
So that's been an important part of my recreational life. Biking, I mean, I like to do the Springwater Trail,
mm-hmm.
and actually, you know, just mountain biking on that to Powell Butte and getting out that way too.
When was the last time you did so?
The last single track,
or on the Springwater.
The Springwater, it would have been over the summer last summer.
Yeah,
yeah.
Okay.
I did a lot of running in the fall, and then.
Mm-hmm.
The election season's been really bad for my exercise routine.
Right. Yeah. Great. the have you ever gotten around transportation wise? Have you ever gotten around by bike for transportation?
Yeah, I've used bike to get around town to do some commuting to work. I've used the bus actually quite a lot when I worked downtown to come down for meetings, and even I was working down here for a full summer for ACLU, and I just took the bus all the time for that. So I prefer not to have to use the single occupancy vehicle, but unfortunately we don't yet have a system that allows us to completely abandon that as part of the portfolio. Particularly for me, I guess I have some issues that force me to use a single occupancy vehicle.
Some people can do it, not everybody can.
Yeah, well, I mean, like it's really hard to go to the mountain snowboarding without that. I mean, there are some other options to get up there, but if you're trying to work up there, the schedule doesn't allow you to use those.
Right.
You know, and as somebody who plays upright bass, mm-hmm. it's kind of hard to transport.
That's harder on the bike.
Particularly with weather issues, you know.
Right.
But I try to make sure that at least when I choose a gasoline-powered vehicle, that I get the most efficient possible model I can. It's always a subcompact. It's mm-hmm. always a five-door. You know, I'm always trying to maximize what I get out and minimize my environmental footprint when I can.
Yeah. What was your first bike? Do you remember?
I had a little Huffy BMX bike. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Back when I grew up in Corvallis, I used to take that down to the BMX track down there. And
cool.
Very much enjoyed that. And then I upgraded to a 10-speed, and that just changed my world.
Hmm.
Just to have the access to be able to get anywhere in a reasonable amount of time.
Yeah.
Like I, you know, before you have an automobile, like that type of freedom that you get when you first have a really decent bicycle is just an amazing thing. It really opens your world up.
Yep.
And I still remember that feeling when I, you know, first, you know, once I got the handle on the 10-speed where I could get it, you know, get used to being up that high off the ground, and then to get around on it was amazing.
Yep. Cool. Yeah. Thanks a lot. I really appreciate your coming in.
Yeah, thanks for chatting.
Yeah. I'm gonna... what's your...